Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
Some secrets are kept in the basement. Others in the morgue. Welcome to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, featuring defense attorney and host of the podcast, Defense Diaries, Bob Mata.
Karen Reed, lots of hearings going on to determine what exactly will be allowed in, what will be allowed out, what will be kicked out of the upcoming trial of Karen Reed, set for April of this year. We'll see if we actually get to that date because there's a lot of things that need to be settled. Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries, joining me to discuss that new hearing just a few days ago, talking about disputes of dog bites and Cellbrite data. Let's start with the dog bites and the original expert that had come on, Dr. Marie Russell. She was in the first case. Her opinion changed a little bit when they came back to her this round. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, Brennan, who's the new prosecutor who they brought on, who interestingly is a defense attorney by trade, they brought him on to try the case in lieu of Adam Lally, who is sitting next to him, which has to be a little bit awkward.
Yeah.
But, you know, Brennan came pretty hard at Dr. Marie Russell, who was their dog bite expert. I mean, when you kind of look at her CV, her resume, she's a pretty learned gal, you know, in terms of she's done it all, including forensic pathology. She's worked in ERs for decades. You know, I mean, she's done a lot of things. She's treated thousands of dog bites, you know, and Allison and I, my wife and partner, were discussing, you know, it's like, I don't know that there is like a real thing as a dog bite expert. You know what I'm saying? Like, if it's not a doctor who's probably seen more dog bites than anybody on the planet, then I don't know who it would be. You know, because you slip into that weird thing where, you know, you're getting into like bite mark analysis, which courts have pretty much rejected. So here you're trying to identify like wound identification based on patterns. And, you know, this was supposed to be a Daubert hearing. And I know that Brennan went at her pretty hard, but it wasn't really a Daubert hearing. So a Daubert hearing is where you're challenging science. Like if one of the sides is trying to come in with some kind of science or a scientific theory that's somewhat novel, or that hasn't been addressed at large by the courts in terms of like, this is acceptable for juries to hear because we find that it will be helpful to the jury in reaching a conclusion as to innocence or guilt. So, but when you typically have a Daubert hearing, you have experts from the state that is challenging the science that the other side is trying to put in, meaning that Brennan should have had somebody rebutting what she was saying. Like Brennan, a lawyer, standing up there just saying, well, I don't think, couldn't it be this? Couldn't it be that? Couldn't it be that? Like, that's not a Daubert hearing. So, you know, I mean, and I always like moving into that, and I had watched the first half of that hearing, which had taken place a couple few weeks ago, I think maybe before the holidays. You know, my thought was then, and it didn't change any after the second, you know, the second part of that hearing, that this is really an issue not of admissibility, meaning whether or not it should come in, whether or not she should be able to testify, but it goes to weight, meaning how much should the jury weigh this one way or the other? How much weight should they give that particular evidence that she's giving? And that's up to the jurors. They can say, well, you know, the Brennan had a pretty like effective cross-examination. Therefore, I'm not really giving her testimony much weight. So like that admissibility versus weight thing is something that lawyers like to lean into when they're hoping that whatever they're trying to get in does get in, and they'll just, you know, they'll make that argument to the judge. Well, judge, this isn't an admissibility issue. It goes to weight, you know, depending on how much weight that the jurors will independently give that particular piece of evidence. So, yeah, I think that, you know, we've got a situation in this case where I thought Elisi gave a very compelling kind of like closing argument. And Elisi was the new Karen Reed attorney who, mm-hmm. if you look him up, the guy's got some street cred.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's from a big New York firm. He's argued quite a bit in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, New York Court of Appeals, New mm-hmm. York Supreme Court. So, I mean, he's got some pedigree. And you could tell that he was up to the task. And I think what I heard is that he decided to come on pro bono. So he like anytime you have a lawyer that does that, they're feeling pretty passionate about a case. You know, and they're also in a financial position to be able to do so.
Sure.
So, I mean, how it's going to shake out will be interesting. But yeah, I mean, like he was getting caught up in the semantics of that key phrase. There's that term of art
yeah.
that you always want to hear an expert say, which is, you know, in my opinion, within a reasonable degree of medical certainty or whatever the field is, that this is my opinion. So, you know, he was lawyering and talking about the use of the word possibly. Whether or not that's going to be effective in him keeping her off the stand, it shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. Because she did slightly change her opinion. But remember, this is a second trial.
Yeah.
You know, like you're not frozen in time from the first trial to the second trial. You know, the thing about a second trial is you can change prosecutors.
True.
You can do more research. She can look at more things that she hadn't looked at the first time she testified. So those things.
That right there, though, look at more things than she looked at first, because it was even brought up to her in there. It was like, well, they're actually, the dog's alive. Chloe, you can still go see Chloe. You can pet Chloe. You can take mouth moldings of Chloe, which actually has already been done. And it was presented to her, hey, you could go visit Chloe. We could give you the molding. Would that be more helpful to your investigation and to your opinion? And her answer, and I'm paraphrasing, was not necessarily. When you're an expert in something and you're trying to narrow down and answer a question for somebody, I don't know. I would think any piece of evidence or data pertaining directly to the thing in question would be helpful. I don't think the correct answer to that is not necessarily, Bob. You know?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I think, but again, that goes to weight.
Yep.
Like that's something that Brennan brings up in front of a jury and says, you know, because that's what a juror is going to think.
Yeah.
Like, oh, well, you had the opportunity to be able to actually measure the distance between Chloe's incisors, but you chose not to do it. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't necessarily think that goes to admissibility. I think it goes to, all right, well, we're not going to give this witness's testimony much credence because she didn't look at things that she could have, mm-hmm. that she had access to, that she decided not to. Well, so
then why?
I mean, because that's like something we always do with any expert. Like if they had the ability to be able to look at other things that they could have used to form an opinion and they chose not to do it, and there's no kind of rational explanation as to why, I think it hurts the credibility of that witness.
It does. And why use her as a witness if she's already, I mean, wouldn't you dump her at this point? She's already been kind of wishy-washy on this. Yes, she has 30 years of ER experience, but it's not experience as a vet or other things that are more specialized in animals specifically. And she's rejected looking at evidence. I think at this point, like, if you want to argue it, I get the idea of arguing it, but she's probably not the sharpest knife to cut through it.
Yeah,
that
goes back to the first thing I was saying.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if there exists in the world like a dog bite expert. And this is unusual.
Yeah.
I was having this conversation when I was covering this over on our channel when we were live streaming the hearing. And like, this is unusual because typically when somebody comes into the ER, with a dog bite wound, and they're alive, they're certain that they were bitten by a dog. So you're not trying to figure out whether or not a dog made these marks or caused these injuries.
Yeah.
Now, if you think about a situation where you have somebody that's deceased, I mean, you're having to talk about a situation where if you're trying to determine what caused these wounds, and then you're looking at the police reports and you're like, okay, well, the person was found in their home. They had died of other causes, and but they had a large dog.
Yeah.
And after the person was deceased, the dog started gnawing on them.
Yeah.
You know, so I guess what I'm trying to say is it's pretty rare where you have a situation where you're trying to figure out where the wounds came from in the context of it being a dog or not being a dog.
Well, yeah.
Because typically if a dog attacks, somebody sees it or the person's alive and says, yeah, a dog bit me or attacked me. You know what I mean? It's like, this is kind of a weird circumstance where
it is.
We're trying to figure out what the hell caused those wounds.
Well, and it doesn't necessarily mean it was Chloe the dog. And it also doesn't necessarily mean that Chloe was in some sort of attack position when going after him either. There's other possibilities here. Like, oh, I don't know, letting your dog out to pee at night. And I don't know that they did. That's never come up in conversation, but I let my dogs out. We have a fenced backyard. Some people don't. Some people, their dogs stay in their front yard. They go do their business, smell around, and come back. If there's a dead body up there in front that you can't really see and the dog's out there doing its thing and it comes back, maybe it did bite a little bit on him if he was down already laying on the ground and didn't report it back to the owners. Hey, by the way, John O'Keefe's down by the mailbox. I bit his arm a little bit. Hey, you're not going to get
dude,
that.
Dude, I'm or with coyotes. You 100%. You know I'm all about the coyote shit.
I'm still going with coyotes. There's a freaking forest behind the house.
Thank you, Tony. And that's why you're my fucking dear friend.
Yeah.
Because I took so much shit about the coyote thing, and I like researched it. I looked like in that area of Massachusetts in that year.
Yeah.
Like they literally brought in federal agencies to help with the coyote issue.
Yes.
Like if O'Keefe is out there for whatever reason, whether he was hit by Karen Reed or whether he took a beating in the house and he's laying out there, to me, those easily could have been, because typically a coyote is not going to feast on its prey in an open area. Like they're going to try to drag the person to a more secluded area, you know, because they're worried about other animals coming and messing with them while they're eating. Or in the event that John O'Keefe was deceased already, I mean, some of the research that I was doing, they don't dig on stuff that's super dead.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it was a distinct possibility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it didn't have to be like, it's one of those mysteries. But to go back to your original question, I felt the same way about whether or not they just ditch her.
I think they should.
And when you know, and like if you're trying to read through the tea leaves a little bit, maybe the problem is that they simply couldn't find another expert that was willing to say those injuries were as a result of a dog or canine. You know, I mean, like I've had cases where I've had an injury. I'm trying to find an expert witness. I've sent the photographs of the injuries, and it was a similar thing where the state was alleging one thing happened. My client was saying that absolutely did not happen, and it was a burn case.
Yeah.
And you know, I kept sending these things out to doctors, you know, and I'm like, and I would give no analysis. Like I wasn't trying to have them form an opinion based on anything that I was saying. I was simply sending the pictures saying, this is a case that I'm handling. I didn't even tell them if it was criminal or civil. And I'm like, does this appear to be a burn to you? Or what do you think the source of this injury was? And like every doctor is like, are you blind? It's a burn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? So I couldn't find, like, it took me forever to find a doctor who finally at least left open the possibility that it was not a burn, but that's not a great witness.
No.
You know what I mean? It's like I've got to put that person on the stand knowing that they're going to get crossed and, you know, they're not going to be able to say with any kind of reasonable degree of medical certainty that it's not a burn. So I I can't say, I'm speculating, obviously, but I mean, I think it's a distinct possibility that they simply, Dr. Marie Russell's it for
is the
them.
Best. And yeah,
that
the
was,
best.
You know, I mean, for a case that's had this much publicity, you would think if there existed in the world, somebody who was equally or more qualified in terms of dog bite wounds, maybe say, for instance, the, I forget what that article they kept citing in the hearing. It was, it had a name. I tried to look it up, but I couldn't spell the name right. Like that guy.
I know you're talking about.
Or that gal. You know, whoever wrote the article. Why, like, why isn't that person, unless they're deceased, of course, and it's, but it seemed to be a relatively recent article. Like, why aren't you calling that person up and saying, hey, you wrote the book?
Or have they already and just didn't get the answer they wanted?
Well, that's always the thing, man.
The other point of contention here in this that they've been arguing about is the Cellbright data. This is the Googling of how's long to die in cold that the accusation is Jennifer McCabe did it at 2:20-something, but maybe it was 6:20-something or something like that. And the initial reaction from, you know, the Karen Reed camp when they had their person who tried to decipher the data, who was not a Cellbright person, by the way, just an officer who said, yeah, it's pretty easy to read. Great, read it. And he came with a 2 a.m. number. Then Cellbright came in, the actual creator of the program that says, you're reading it wrong. This is actually how it is. This is more for us to read on our end and a technical end, but here's technically what it is. There's time zone changes. There's things like this. We kind of operate with a Greenwich Mean Time or whatever, and it stays a certain stamp, so it's not always going to be accurate. Here's how to truly read it. When you read it correctly, it's 6-something. They don't like that answer. That doesn't go with the narrative. So facts be damned, and the actual company that has the instructions that say this is how to read it, they're saying, eh, we like reading it our own way. How is this an issue? And I know the judge, Judge Beverly, is looking at this going, should we allow the other witness in? And I know there's a recent ruling in another case that they let non-experts, you know, non-cell phone people in to give their expert opinion. So that's weighing on this as well. But I'm sorry, this is one where it's a fact, it's a fact. I don't care what side you're on. The experts told you this is how the program works. That's kind of end-all be-all for me. I don't really care what someone thinks it works or how they think it works if they're just not right.
Yeah, like, in, I can't remember. What was his name, the Cellbright guy? Do you remember his name? I can't remember
I'll
what his
find
name
it,
was.
But yeah.
But so the issue with him was that he wasn't quite that definitive. Like, he had an opinion on it, but remember, what kind of came out during his testimony is that he was actually creating his own software to deal with the deficiencies contained within Cellbright.
Which Cellbright then instituted and is actually across all their platforms now, because when they updated it, they decided to update it to be a little more clear on what the times actually mean, and then it translated them into accurate times.
Yeah, because it wasn't even... It wasn't even a time thing as much as where the information was being stored.
Yeah.
And like an overriding thing. Like here's the way I felt. And I watched all of that testimony a couple of times because, Tony, the one thing that I wanted to know going into that fucking case was whether or not that text or whether or not that Google search took place at that time. Like, to me, that the entire case hinged on it.
Yeah.
Because if she's texting or if she's Googling that at that time, to me, it's game over, reasonable doubt. Like, why would she be doing that at that time? It makes no fucking sense. Like, she clearly, that means that they knew that he was laying out there. So, and I watched the testimony. I didn't find it as compelling as you did. I just didn't. And I got no dog in the hunt.
Yeah.
I'm in neither camp, you know, like I was the big third. You know, third theory guy.
Yeah.
You know, I really was, you know, so it was like, you know, and I take shit for it and I don't care. I could care less. Yeah. I have my own opinion. No one ever sways me on what I should think. I don't give a shit.
Yep.
You know, and I just, when you have some question, because experts are giving opinions, you know, and again, that goes to weight. You know, you're talking about weight. When you got, like, for you as a juror, if you've got that guy coming in who works for the damn company, you're giving that dude a ton of weight.
Yeah.
As a juror. You know what I mean? Like, you're just, you're doing it. You're saying, I don't give a fuck what that guy said from the defense, Green.
But I don't know that
matter to me because they got a guy from the company, and that guy from the company, you know what I'm saying? That goes to weight, not admissibility.
You and me look at it that way. I think a lot of people look at it that way. Not everybody looks at it that way. If just the words came out of someone's mouth, if they saw it in a tweet, if they read it somewhere, if it's on the internet, if it's what the fuck ever, Uncle Billy told me this one day, and I'm going to believe this now for the rest of my life. People have a hard time deciphering the weight of what an expert opinion is. And that's true. The scary part today. There are certainly experts out in industries, but people don't like to rely on their opinions. They like to think, I'm just as smart as you. And I mean, well, some people do. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people that like to think they're just as smart as everybody else who's done everything. Instead of yielding and going, oh, this is, you made this? Well, clearly that's what it is. I don't think self-righteous.
Welcome to the life of a lawyer, dude. That's the thing that you're always terrified about. Like, for instance, from like a defense attorney's perspective, I'm always mortified when, like, say, like, let's talk about the other case that we talk about all the time. When you talk about the unspent casing, I know from experience that if they're putting a lab tech that works for law enforcement on the stand to say that there's a match, they, being the jury, is going to give more weight to that witness than anybody I put on the stand.
Yep.
That's just because in the minds of jurors, they give more weight to law enforcement. They're the official agency. They do this for a living. They're the ones who are collecting the clues and they're evaluating the evidence. And juries just are more inclined to believe that witness than they are to somebody naysaying it. Sure. And it doesn't matter. I mean, everybody makes all the lawyers make all the arguments. Right? Well, that's an employee of the state. They're going to say whatever the hell they need to say, you know, the state needs them to say in order to get a conviction. And it's the counter argument with the defense. Well, that guy's a hired gun. Mm-hmm. They're going to say whatever the defense needs them to say in order to get a not guilty. So it's like I always feel that experts, at least I always hope that they X each other out if the defense expert is compelling enough, you know, and that's best case scenario. Like, I think it's like you have to have like an unbelievably smoking gun, like expert witness on the defense to override whatever the state's putting just in general. Mm-hmm. I mean, jurors typically are just going to give more weight to the state's witness. So yeah, man, it's one of those things. And that hearing's coming up. We're going to see if they're going to allow Green in, you know, I mean, I think she's going to have to, because again, they have the opportunity to put on a defense.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. You know, you can't just decide. It's not the judge's within her purview to decide that the defense can't put forth a defense and challenge evidence by putting their own expert on. You know, it's like you've got to leave it to the jurors to decide, okay, I'm buying what this guy is selling and I'm not buying what that person's selling. Well,
And I get that. But in this specific area with the Cellbright data, the company is literally saying, here's what it truly is. This is, I get you, your guy over here there thought that's what it was, but it's not. So isn't that up to the judge to say, look, your guy over here is wrong. That's just, it is what it is. The company that makes it says this. I mean,
No, because Cellbright is like, Cellbright's not the end all, man.
But it's their data. They're telling you how to decipher their own data.
But
so if I decide to not read their directions and go, I think it means this, and I'm wrong, it shouldn't be valid in court.
There are companies that exist in order to try to get the secret sauce of Apple. Entire companies, and Cellbright is one of them.
Yeah.
They exist because they've been trying to figure out what the secret sauce of Apple is, what's under their hood, how does it work? Because Apple doesn't tell anybody a damn thing. Mm-hmm. They keep all of their proprietary shit super secret. And there are literally very, very financially healthy companies that exist merely because they spend all their time, money, and resources trying to break Apple's code and figure out what the fuck they have in those phones that is basically tracking every single part of our lives.
Yeah, yeah.
From health data, it's all of it. So, I mean, and Cellebrite's just a company that's doing that. I mean, they're literally one of those companies that does it. And now they have competitors. A lot of law enforcement has shifted away from Cellebrite. All I'm saying to you is Cellebrite's not so definitive that I think that Judge Bev can sit on the bench and say, well, that's it. Like Cellebrite's the end all be all. Whatever that corporation says and whatever one of their employees says and how it works, that's definitive for me. Like that's she's deciding an issue of fact. That is left for the trier of fact. That is left for the jury. That's my point, man. Okay. You just can't. Like, that's not for the judge to decide. Now, if she decides that, look, this is junk that your guy is bringing in, meaning Green, that's a different story. Mm-hmm. Like, if she's like, I just don't find him to be learned enough to be able to rebut. Like, he's not bringing anything to the table. He's just coming in with a word salad. And he's not giving any kind of alternate theory. He's just saying the opposite of what their expert is saying, but not giving any basis behind it. There's no science behind what he's saying. That's a different story. You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, you always want to be able to challenge evidence.
Sure.
You know, I mean, but, and really, you see this a lot more from the defense where they're trying to keep out science that the state's trying to put forth. I mean, that's typically what you see. That's not to say that it doesn't happen the other way, because it does.
Yeah.
But typically it's us trying to keep out some new tech, some new science. Mm-hmm. They're coming in. They're like, I had a case where there was this new company called True Allele, and they were able to take YSTR data, and they were able to extrapolate it to a much in their what they were claiming was that they were able to give us a much greater analysis. However, when we had our DNA expert who wanted to look at their algorithm, what was their black box stuff, the guy was like, there's no way. He's like, I'm never going to turn that over. It's proprietary. Yeah. If I give that out, then every company on the planet now has. But the problem with that was that he couldn't prove his science.
Yeah.
We had no way to prove what he was saying was true. So, like, you know, and in that case, the judge excluded True Allele. Mm-hmm. Now, that company, I've checked in on that company, like in the world of courts, they've been able to make their way in. I don't know how. I don't know if he just, you know, they had judges that, because I mean, you need peer review.
Yeah.
Like, you have to have peer review to make sure that, you know, what you're saying is legitimate. I mean, you can't just trust some dude.
Sure, yeah.
Like, hey, I'm a scientist. I said it so it's so. No, yeah. Show me the work, bro. I need to see the work. So yeah. I hear what you're saying. That'll be another really interesting hearing with Green. Yeah, you know, in my opinion, I did not feel that Green was the strongest witness either. You know, but again, like, we've had this discussion about Karen Reed. In my opinion, and now we know they're trying to keep the two witnesses that I've said I would abandon the whole conspiracy thing and just put Rensselaer and Wolf on. And during that hearing, we found out that they had filed a motion, they being the state, had filed a motion to keep Rensselaer and Wolf out under the Rule 14, which is reciprocal discovery, meaning that each side has to turn over their evidence. And if they have reports, they have to turn it over. So there's some issue, because this was a Fed issue. It was the DOJ had ordered this investigation. There's some kind of issue with the defense being able to turn over something that Brennan is claiming that they have to have in order for those guys to be able to testify. So Brennan's attacking at every front.
Yeah.
He's trying to chip away at every possible defense that they have. You know, because that was my thing. I've told you, and I think we probably both agree on this fact, that selling that conspiracy theory to 12 people is really hard to do.
Yeah.
Just is. It's really hard to sell conspiracy theories to 12 people.
Well, especially when you don't really have a lot of evidence to back it up. I mean, and you can go into, well, they didn't investigate it. I get that. But again, there's just not a lot to back it up.
There's a lot of smoke.
There is.
You know, there's a lot of smoke that if you couch it properly, which the defense did, can certainly appear that something may have happened in that house. You know, I mean, it's like, this is one of those cases where I just don't know if we'll ever get the truth.
I don't think we will. At the end of the day.
And it's like, frustrating, right? You know, because it's like the defense is, I mean, they have convinced a massive amount of people that what they're claiming took place in that house took place. Mm-hmm. They like, this isn't like a few like tinfoil hat crackpots.
No,
like their work in terms of the defense, in terms of crafting that motion to dismiss and putting this theory out, has convinced a ton of people.
Yeah.
That is what happened, that cannot be swayed.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, and it's the same thing. That's what's so frustrating about the case, because I'm equally not as compelled with the state's theory. I mean, could he have been hit by this SUV? Yes, he could have. However, the question for me has always been the injuries. They just don't match up. It's truly been like, dude, like my whole thing that he slipped and cracked the back of his skull walking up the driveway and staggered and fell, to me, is frankly the most reasonable explanation of what happened to him.
It seems logical. I mean, it's like, I think a lot of us, if you've grown up or have been at a point in your life in a cold atmosphere, and if you've had beverages in your life, you've had times where you slip, you're like, oh shit, you know, I mean, and you go, that could have been really bad if I was alone or something, you know. It's reasonable.
This is not dry concrete. This is a dude who was shit faced.
Yeah.
And I don't know what, like he had the sneakers on.
Yeah.
Like, I have.
It's logical. Look,
it's a completely logical thing. And like, I kept posting, I went on to like all the JPEGs.
Yeah.
And like, I found one of a dude slipping on a patch of ice, mm-hmm, and like, just smashing the back of his head when he hits the ground. His back hits, and his head just cracks. It's like exactly where he would hit the head.
And that's where
it doesn't knock him out cold, right? At the moment, he gets up, he staggers into the yard, he's out.
Yep.
You know, and then people are like, well, how did everybody not see him when they're walking out? I'm like, because he's by the fucking hydrant and it's dark and they're drunk. I don't know.
Exactly. Like, can you tell me at any time if you're dark and you're drunk in your house, what's going on at the edge of your yard that you can't see?
I'm talking about even the people who left.
Exactly.
Like that
night. You don't pay attention that much. No. The other overarching piece of the Karen Reed case that puts, I think, and enables a lot of the dismissal of a lot of evidence, or the playing down, or the possibility that maybe there's something else going on here. It's one man, Michael Proctor, and he's having his disciplinary hearing, or pretty much the probably dismissal hearing coming up this week. And hopefully he's done. Hopefully it's not like, well, we'll give you something else to do. I can't imagine you want this man in any way, shape, or form associated with law enforcement, no matter what side you're on. It's just not a good look. It's not going to help.
He's a piece of shit.
That's not who
you want as cops.
But inevitably,
you don't want douchebags like that being cops. Like, the guy's just a tool, man.
But inevitably,
you know, exactly what you said. I don't give a shit what side you're on. That guy's a fucking turd.
And he's not going to be a big help for the state. He certainly was a help for the prosecution, and he's, I'm sure, going to be called up again. And he's going to go through the, hey, let's read your texts again, because that was real comfortable the first time around. And yeah, I mean, it really paints a picture. And then you also look at the other cases he's been involved in. I'm sure a lot of these will not be allowed into the Karen Reed case, but Sandra Birchmore, there's a lot of question there. He was at the beginning of that case, a case that was ruled a suicide, which clearly shouldn't have been, but he was part of that whole thing. There's other cases, too, which are shocking that we follow, that his name pops up. Brian Walsh, I don't really see a whole lot of
Brian Walsh. There. I mean, I think he was periphery on that one, but dude, it's like...
But there's others, too, that have been long and settled. Miles King, Sean Johnson, there's some others as well where they're going to take a look back and go, was there some sort of bias going on here? Because this seems to be how this guy operated. obviously, we were just finding all this out. We didn't even know half of it when the Karen Reed trial part one was going on. And that kind of sparked the look into him and the investigation into him. Round two, it's all out there in the open that we know about Michael Proctor. How do you think that's going to affect a jury round two now that, we got the full story on Proctor this time?
It's so intertwined with the conspiracy theory that I think that it's going to land the same way. You know, like I just think it's going to be impossible to get 12 jurors on there to buy that entire theory. And the way that they're working Proctor, as opposed to the way that I like that you worked it, which was a bias that he just formed tunnel vision, mm-hmm. as opposed to him being a giant piece of shit who's, you know, buddies with the Alberts and is doing their bidding, mm-hmm. because those are two different things. One, you're talking about just a cop who forms tunnel vision and, you know, and he thought Karen was a piece of shit. So like, that was it. It was open and shut for him. That's a different thing than him doing some really bad shit that cops should never do in terms of planting evidence and things like that. You know, those are two completely different things. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah. I mean, it depends on how the defense goes. And if their intent is to continue to, and you can be assured that Brennan's going to be attacking that third party culprit. I'm assuming that's next on the list, but time is short. They were already concerned with when they were going to fit in the Green hearing, you know, because April is court, April is trial. So like in that'll be here in the blink of an eye. So, I mean, if Brennan's intent is to try to keep up that third party culprit defense and he thinks he can do it more effectively, I mean, to me, it's going to be res judicata, which means that the issue's already been decided. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I don't know if there's going to be a way that he can work around that, but I'd be surprised if he doesn't try to attack it in some way.
Without a Proctor issue, would the conspiracy theory be as effective as it is? And they are completely separate. There's nothing in the conspiracy that involves Proctor. That's a whole separate thing. But when you put that shade of darkness over this whole case, it starts to make the conspiracy look a lot more appealing. I'm wondering if this has been part of the strategy all along, knowing, look, we got Proctor shit here that's going to, you know, completely stain everything. If we come with this story of this, the dog bite and there was a fight, it's going to have that much more weight because we're already going onto a sinking ship because of Proctor.
No. And the reason we know that, because remember that motion to dismiss, like before this case was on anybody's radar, when mm-hmm. this was just a potential, you know, DUI resulting in a homicide case, which happened quite a bit, right? Yeah. I mean, they're typically not worldwide cases. Yeah. Like, I mean, they happen in counties all over this country all the fucking time. So when they filed the motion to dismiss, they didn't have the TUI information.
True.
So you know what I'm saying? Like when that thing came out, like it was out for like that motion had been filed for a hot minute for months before anybody was like, whoa, what the fuck is going on here?
Yeah.
And, you know, so they didn't have all that dirt on Proctor, you know, so they were more leaning on the relationships, mm-hmm. that there were these relationships. Canton's a small town, you know, Proctor's, he knows people, he's got friends, there's friends. It was kind of the intertwining of relationships and the fact that there were cops in that house. You're dealing with a Boston cop who's deceased. You know, it was that kind of that tangled web that I think led them to that. And then, you know, they were able to kind of build it. And then when they get the DOJ report, that was just for them, the cherry on top, man. You know, I mean, that was just added fuel for them to really try to sell it. So, I mean, God, you know, I mean, the state just doesn't want him on because he's a fucking horrible human being.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he doesn't help you. He just makes all cops look bad.
He does. Yeah. He's a horrible representation of anything.
Right. No cop wants that guy on the stand. Like, I mean, he's cancerous. Like, you just don't, like, no one wants him other than defense. But how much he helps in the scope. He didn't help. Like, they heard it all, T.
Yeah.
They heard it all, and they didn't get an NG.
No.
And if we're to believe, you know, what we've heard about what the count was on the manslaughter, it was 9-3 as to guilt.
Yeah. I think we.
Well, like, from the defense side of it, you know, I think about this. I'm like, if you're on the defense side of it, Tony, like, and you, if you believe that that was the count, like, what, like, you must realize that you have to change something, mm-hmm. right? Because you got it all out there.
Yeah,
you put it all out there. Like, and if and we now know that the Dr. Russell's testimony is going to be substantially similar. Mm-hmm. Like that wasn't compelling enough. Like, clearly they didn't buy the Cellbrite shit or the Google search shit. You know what I'm saying? It's like, you're the defense. What do you do? You got to change your shit up.
Each side is coming in with pretty much the same information for the most part, maybe remixed a little bit. And none of it is it's all about as clear as mud still, and will still be to a jury. I don't know how you don't end up with another hung jury on this, at least as of now, with what we're seeing.
I will be stunned if Brennan decides to take the Lally approach and do the pre-buttal case where he tried, literally Lally, what he did for the first two and a half weeks of that trial was tried the defense's case. Mm-hmm. He got in front of it. Like, he, because remember, the ruling by Judge Bev, I believe, was that she was going to let them develop their third party culprit mm-hmm. defense through cross examination during the case in chief of the state. And if at the conclusion of the state's case in chief, she thought that they had developed enough evidence mm-hmm. that there was a nexus, that it was worth bringing to the jury, that she would allow them to call witnesses and put on their defense as far as a third party culprit. Mm-hmm. What Lally decided to do was get in front of it all. He's like, I'm not going to let them call these witnesses. I'm going to get in front of it. I'm going to prep them. I'm going to put them all on. And I would be stunned if Brennan does the same thing.
Yeah.
Like, if we don't see an attack by Brennan, it's because I don't think Brennan's going to, he's not going to even acknowledge that they exist.
Yeah.
He's not going to call any of them. He'll call whoever he needs to call just to talk about the fact that John O'Keefe, he's going to do exactly what they did at Delphi, which is you call up the witnesses and you're going to limit the scope of the direct examination to one question. Or two questions. Did John O'Keefe come to the house? No, nothing further.
Yeah.
And then when the defense tries to dig in, you know, she'll give them a little leeway, but they're not going to be able to get into all that shit, man. So, like, Brennan's going to, I would imagine that Brennan's going to have a very, very different approach to the state's case in chief because of Judge Bev's ruling, mm-hmm. you know, like, I think ultimately they decided that that was a horrible technique. And I thought it was mildly interesting. It was an interesting way to try to get in front of it.
Yeah.
As opposed to like allowing the defense to put that shit all out there because the state goes first.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of times if you don't feel that you have a super compelling case as the state, you know, because like as defense attorneys were like, oh man, the state gets to tell their story first. And you're always worried that the judge is going to form their opinion based on the state. So you're always telling the jury during opening statements, please wait. Like hear them out, but please wait and then hear us out, you know, because you're always concerned about that. So yeah, we'll see how it goes, man. It's like, it's one of those cases that's, you know, it's why I love trials, man. They're fascinating. It's the human condition. It's fucking crazy.
It's like we're repeating last year though. We were having this exact same conversation around this time last year.
It's going to be a very different trial.
It will be. Yeah. And buckle up. Here it comes.
Yep.
Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
Let's be honest. Nothing kills the thrill of a good murder mystery like a commercial for laundry detergent. It's like someone slapping a closed sign on your favorite dive bar. But you're not here for that, are you? You're here for the good stuff. So ditch the ads and upgrade to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts. With True Crime Today Premium Plus, you get your crime straight. No chaser. Commercial free with extended interviews and early access. It's like getting the bartender's special when the bar's already closed. Search for True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts. Subscribe and drink it all in.